Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're trying to answer some of the very serious errors in history and church belief and church doctrine that the Da Vinci Code in its novel presents as authentic history. We've been talking now, this is our 17th series, with our guest Ron Eldred, who teaches down at John Paul II Catholic High, world history, American history, religion, and government. And I'm your host on the program, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus here at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar, with the shamrock at the intersection of the streets. Ron, welcome once again. We've been talking about Gnostic writings, or these hidden writings, or these that keep, we would call them, church would call them, counterfeit writings. And as the U.S. government tries to keep counterfeit money from circulating, the church has always tried to keep counterfeit gospels from trying to pass off as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So the church has been, for the centuries, trying to give that service to us. And when we hear about all these inauthentic or Gnostic gospels that have presented themselves in the early centuries of the church, it's no wonder we needed somebody to filter them so we knew what we were reading was authentic. So, Ron, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the Gnostic writings, or these counterfeit gospels and epistles and acts of the apostles that Dan Brown uses as sources for the Da Vinci Code, and therefore claims that they're really from authentic historical documents.
In the last session, we talked about there were basically two types of Gnosticism. One was the Persian type, which, since it's not been too influential, we didn't say much about. The other type, of course, is the Syrian Egyptian type. And we spent one whole half hour session, you know, talking about the Syrian Egyptian type. But most of the texts that influence the Da Vinci Code, or at least the sources that Dan Brown relies upon, such as Elaine Pagels in her book, The Gnostic Gospels, were written by Syrian Egyptian Gnostics in between the 2nd and the 5th centuries AD. And these include classical Gnostic scripture. They include sometimes are referred to as the Sethian, Sethian after Seth, S-E-T-H, Sethian Gnosticism, named after Seth, the third son of Adam and Eve, and who was believed to be a possessor and disseminator of special knowledge, according to Gnostics now.
Gnosticism is always proclaimed to be giving special knowledge.
Yeah, secret knowledge. Yes.
Secret and special knowledge.
Many texts have been attributed to this school, including the Apocryphon of John, or the secret book of John, the Apocalypse of Adam, the Gospel of the Egyptians. Another brand of Gnosticism is called Thomasine, named after St. Thomas, and several texts are attributed to him, such as the Hymn of the Pearl, the Gospel of Thomas. In fact, the Gospel of Thomas is the most famous one of all the Gnostic Gospels.
Okay.
And the Book of Thomas, sometimes called Thomas the Contender. And then there's another very important type of Gnostic writings, and these are what are called the Valentinians, named after the Christian Gnostic teacher of Valentinius, who lived from about 100 to 153 AD. And he developed one of the most complex cosmologies to be found in Gnosticism, including outside the Scythian tradition that we mentioned a while ago. And he was, for a time, the most successful Christian Gnostic thinker. In fact, Tertullian, in one of his books he wrote to refute Valentinius, tells us that he was a candidate for bishop, presumably of Rome.
Wow.
In the year about the year 143, in other words, for Pope. Valentinian's writings include the Gospel of Truth, the prayer of Paul the Apostle, treatise on the resurrection, and the Gospel of Philip. The Gospel of Philip is probably second to the Gospel of Thomas in terms of notoriety.
Okay.
Also, the Gospel of Truth falls in there about third. In fact, I was watching a program the other night on the Gospel of Judas, and Elaine Pagels, who is one of the top scholars in that whole field, she referred to all three of those Gospels in her discussion.
Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, and the Gospel of Truth?
The Gospel of Truth. And those are all Valentinian.
Okay.
Variety of Gnosticism.
And these are things that the church kept filtering out and saying, no, we stand with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These are counterfeit Gospels.
Yes, they're counterfeit Gospels.
Writing.
Although a lot of people today are making claims that they were legitimate Gospels.
And that's where it's coming up in so many media programs.
Yes.
They're becoming very popular.
Well, that's what the Da Vinci Code's claiming. That these are valid, truthful Gospels.
Okay.
And there was one more important group in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, Gnostics. These were the Basilidians, named after the founder of their school, Basilides, who was believed to be born around 132 A.D. Most of what we know of him and his movement is known mainly through the summaries of Irenaeus against heresies. And through a series of fragments found in the work of Clement of Alexandria. And some of his writings included the uniqueness of the word. Usually haven't heard too much about these. I'll just name two or three of them. The state of virtue, the reincarnation, several different documents. I've never even come across these myself. I've come across his name several times in history. As one of the early heretics that the church had to deal with. But Valentinius is the name that really, when you study world history, when you teach world history, Valentinius' name really comes up very prominent.
Okay, so most of us in our listening audience would probably have no idea that down through the centuries the church was filtering out these inauthentic counterfeit documents claiming to be a real descriptions of Jesus and his teachings and his church. Most Christians would probably just be aware of that there is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it was the Catholic Church who kept those, defended, protected them from all these other spurious or counterfeit documents floating around.
And as I said in an earlier session, all we knew about these heresies was what the church fathers had written down at length, the quote, so they could refute them. It was only until 19, and there may have been a few documents here and there hidden in monastery libraries and things like that, but most of them were either destroyed by the church or the Roman Empire when it became Christian. And a few of these, as I said, got through, and some of them were hidden. In fact, in 1945, as we mentioned in our last session, about 50 of these were found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, in 1945. And so that's what's stimulated. That is what's really stimulated this surge of interest in these Gospels now, is the so-called, quote, discovery of these Gospels at Nag Hammadi. And the Gospel of Judas, which was found somewhere fairly close to where Nag Hammadi's at.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, may I ask you, I think you said Nag Hammadi were books rather than scrolls?
Yeah, they were codices, as they call them.
And where were they found?
In a cave in
Much
Egypt.
Like Qumran?
Well, it wasn't up in a mountainside or something like the Qumran overlooking the Dead Sea, but it was a cave somewhere.
Okay.
It was not easily accessible from what I understand.
And because of the dryness of the climate and the like, they actually were preserved.
Yes, they were papyri, made of papyrus, and of course, that doesn't hold up too well, but in that dry climate,
sure,
they have held up.
So you're saying that the reason for this multiplicity of programs now that are on television about the Gnostic or the hidden gospels that have been discovered. Now we know things we never knew before about Jesus, is because of this Nag Hammadi discovery in 1945.
Yes.
Okay, but the church knew about them because the early church fathers, Tertullian and Irenaeus, they were refuting them with long passages in their writings and saying, this cannot be accepted as authentic gospel teaching.
Yeah, way back in the second century, they were okay. In third centuries, they were
So I think it just reminds us, at least reminds me, of that old Catholic saying that the Catholic Church is the mother of the Bible, and that the Bible is the daughter of the church, that without the church's guidance and filtering out all these counterfeit documents, that we wouldn't really know what books belong in the Bible.
St. Augustine said in the fourth century that I could not believe in the Bible without the church, because the church was there. The church witnesses these events. The church wrote them down. The church transmitted them, and the church has interpreted them and protected them, preserved them.
Okay, and what they're trying to tell us now on many of these programs is, hey, the church has really been fooling us, and now we know things that we didn't know, and this is the truth about Jesus, and he really wasn't God, and he really was married to Mary Magdalene, and et cetera, et cetera. How about this Gospel of Judas? You mentioned it a few sentences ago. That's been getting some play in the popular magazines.
Oh, yes. In fact, even St. Irenaeus, if I recall right, had written about the Gospel of Judas, but we never had a copy of it until it was found, I think it was probably in the late 40s, maybe the 50s, I'm not exactly sure. I watched a two-hour program the other night about it, and it never was really real definitive as to exactly when it was found and what have you, because I think they don't really know for sure. Some okay. Man found it, some Egyptian found it, and it okay. went in kind of underground for a number of years.
But remind me again of the more or less dates of Irenaeus, who was very early.
Well, yeah, he was flourishing. That is, that was the main part of his life when he was doing his best work. When in the 180s,
okay.
Something like that. So a long time ago, second century, mid okay. to late second century.
Okay, and he was a stalwart, giant defender of the faith, and he wrote this book on Verses Hereses, against the heretics, against those who were circulating counterfeit documents and doctrines. And you know, I always think if we see the church as a protector and guide for us, just like the government tries to keep false currency, and some of that false currency is hard to tell the difference between a genuine and a counterfeit $100 bill.
Well, for some reason, the National Geographic has been really promoting this Gospel of Judas. In fact, I understand that they published an English translation of it, and they've been aggressively promoting it in the mass media, especially in their magazine and on the National Geographic Channel. In fact, this is where I saw the two-hour program the other night, was on the National Geographic Channel. But this gospel portrays Judas Iscariot as the most enlightened of the disciples, who acted at Jesus' request when he handed him over to the authorities. The Gnostic flavor of this gospel is readily apparent because Judas helps Jesus in his redemptive role by facilitating his death, which liberated him from his evil material body. When we explain Gnosticism, I think it'll begin to be kind of clear what I just said there and what that means.
Well, and you said earlier that one of the fundamental cores of Gnosticism, or hidden revelation or hidden knowledge, is that the material is evil and that the spiritual is good. And so if Jesus is getting freed from his material body, that's a wonderful thing. And since we believe in the resurrection of the dead, we know we're going to get our body back at the last judgment, and that so the body is so good, it's going to be with us forever in heaven, or forever with us in hell. It's not going to be something that's cast off. Okay. key question here, Ron. When will the Gnostic texts, these hidden wisdom, are these counterfeit Gospels, epistles, and Acts written?
Well, that's a critical question. Scholars have varying opinions when these texts were written, but most of them date the Gnostic texts later than the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In fact, much later in most cases. However, there exists a small fringe of radical scholars who date some of them around the time that the canonical Gospels were written, that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, especially Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Or in the case of the Gospel of Thomas, even a little earlier. Some scholars will claim that Thomas was actually written before the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Okay.
Scholars in the Radical Jesus Seminar claim that Thomas was written before the Gospels and that the evangelists used it in an imaginary document. These scholars and other scholars have called Q, which means quell, the German word for source. And they especially like Thomas because it contains many Gnostic sayings attributed to Jesus. They like this interpretation because they claim that Jesus was nothing more than a teacher or sage who brought salvation to the world by teaching secret knowledge, rather than being the Son of God who saved the world by his suffering, death, and resurrection. Olson and Meisel, whom we've quoted many times from their book, The Da Vinci Hoax, they tell us that accurate dating of the books of the New Testament in the Gnostic text is essential to appreciating the serious errors that Dan Brown makes in the Da Vinci Code and in other neo-Gnostic works that exist. They say that if Gnostic works, such as the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Thomas, were written about the same time as the canonical Gospels and St. Paul's letters and the other New Testament books, which are dated by most scholars from about 50 to 100 AD, then a plausible argument can be made that the early church resembles the picture painted by Gnostic and feminist scholars. We argue that various groups existed on an equal footing, at least for a while, within a democratic, theologically fluid era. You see, I was watching this program I mentioned a while ago, the Gospel of Judas, and the lead scholar they had on there many times, she was on there twice as much as any other scholar, Elaine Pagels, and she made that claim again and again, and I've heard her on other programs and read where she has said that there was a time when all of the Christian groups were all on an equal plane, and that all of their writings were basically all on an equal plane, and that, but eventually, of course, when the Orthodox Christians got the support of Constantine and the Roman Emperor, of course, and then called the Council at Nicaea, and we've already talked about that and refuted that particular claim.
Okay, and I just want to say we're recording this in December of 2006, and so Ron is talking about programs he's seen in the last couple of days, that this is fresh material that's coming out because of these Gnostic Gospels, our hidden wisdom, our counterfeit claims to be equal to the real Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah, what they're really claiming here is that these Gnostic Gospels, at least many of them, were written about the time the Gospels were. And that so they basically were all essentially on kind of a equal plane. And
But isn't it a fact that the Gnostic Gospels or these counterfeit Gospels were written actually much later?
Yes. Olson and Meisel tell us that if the Gnostic books weren't written until several decades or even centuries after the New Testament books, we get a wholly different picture. In this scenario, we get a picture of the Gnostic writings as the result of an intense struggle of heretical sects against the established teachings of the Apostolic Catholic Church. Competent historians claim that these struggles erupted in the second century, especially around 135 to 165 AD, and continued for quite a long period, several centuries actually. For example, St. Irenaeus wrote his great refutation of Gnosticism against heresies, especially against the Valentinians, around 180 AD. So the point is that, again, the Gnostic Gospels were not written when around the time that the first century, between, let's say, 50 and 100 A.D., when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written. They weren't written till the mid to the late part of the next century and on into the next century.
Okay. So they weren't just existing on an equal basis, and that you could take one or take the other.
They certainly weren't eyewitness accounts.
Okay.
Written within, you know, a short time after the events.
And we claim that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were eyewitness accounts.
That's correct.
Are written from people who were eyewitnesses.
That's correct.
Okay, because I think, you know, the old Spinoza argument that if you want to destroy a person's faith, keep presenting questions, and raise doubts. You know, there's an old saying, a fool can ask more questions in 20 minutes than a wise man could answer in 2 years. A person can keep raising questions without any substantial evidence that these questions are based on any kind of reality. So I think that's the danger. People say, well, some scholars say this, some scholars say that. I don't have time to look into all this, and I can't filter out all this. So who knows what's right to believe or what's wrong to believe? And again, we're back to, that's why we say Jesus told the apostles, you go out and teach all nations what I have taught you. He who hears you will hear me. And that Jesus did, contrary to the Da Vinci Code, set up Peter as the head of the teaching authority, the magisterium in the church, and that is carried down for 2,000 years. So it's the only way that I can, the reason I'm a priest for 55 years is because without the guidance and the teachings of the church, I couldn't have time to study all of those different scholars who say this, say that, present this. Here's what the church has clearly taught us with the guidance of the Spirit. So you're saying, in other words, the Catholic Church was already well established when these Gnostic or counterfeit heresies were developed.
And that's right.
Okay.
Olson and Meisel, as well as Philip Jenkins in his Hidden Gospels, whom we've quoted several times, and another scholar by the name of Bart Ehrman in his Lost Christianities. In fact, he was one of the scholars that was on the program I saw the other night.
Oh, really?
On the Gospel of Judas. And others maintain that Gnosticism didn't begin to raise its ugly head until the mid-second century, many decades after the life of Christ and the apostles and the formation of the early church that we read about, especially in Acts of the Apostles. Olson and Meisel state that this represents a period of time similar to a modern-day scholar's looking back at the lives of Abraham Lincoln or even George Washington. This means that Gnosticism was a movement that arose outside Christianity. And some Gnostic proponents claim that Simon Magus, for example, we read about him in the Acts of the Apostles, represented a full-fledged Gnosticism within the early church. But this view simply is just a big guess. They point out that, Olson and Meisel point out that Hans Jonas, one of the greatest scholars of all time on the subject of Gnosticism, writes in his The Gnostic Religion that Simon Magus, quote, was not a dissident Christian. And if the church fathers cast him in the role of the arch heretic, they implicitly admitted that Gnosticism was not an inner Christian phenomenon, end of quote. And even some scholars who look favorably on the Gnostic writings, such as James M. Robinson, who edited the Nag Hammadi Library, admitted that they weren't written until the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries. In spite of this, some of these scholars, still insist that the Gnostic writings should be considered just as authoritative as the four Gospels. After examining the Gospel of Mary and other Gnostic texts, Philip Jenkins concludes in his Hidden Gospels, we've quoted him several times, quote, These uncanonical texts were written at a time when the episcopal hierarchy was already well established, when the early house churches were distant memory, and when the canonical gospels were already widely known as the principal authorities for the life of Jesus. Mary and its like, he's talking about the Gospel of Mary, and its like, from a time when the church had already fixed its gospel canon at 4, end of quote.
Okay, now we're kind of stressing this, these counterfeit gospels, because they've been on television again recently. They've been surfacing, the Gospel of Judas. And you said the most popular of the Gnostic Gospels is Thomas.
The Gospel of Thomas.
And then the
Philip.
Philip.
And then Mary Magdalene.
And then you said that one about the Gospel of Truth.
The Gospel of Truth, that was a Valentinian.
Okay, I never heritage. Heard of that one. But these things are coming up on discussions, supposedly, on historically researched programs, such as National Geographic. And
they're really offering them as alternatives to the Gospel, to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's really what it results in.
Okay. And obviously, that's pulling the rug out of underneath what the church has always taught us about the authenticity of the four gospel writers. All right, is there any historical proof about this, that these hidden gospels turned up a lot later?
Yes, there is. In fact, it's amply documented by many sources. For example, during the mid-second century, Justin Martyr and his first apology explained the Christian liturgy to non-Christians and describes the Gospels written by the apostles. About the same time, Tertullian, in his five books against Marcion, who was a quasi-Gnostic, defended the four Gospels, the Acts of the Apostles, St. Paul's Epistles, the Epistle to the Hebrews, 1 John, and the Apocalypse. It was only a couple of decades later that Irenaeus of Lyon, in his Against Heresy, specifically discusses the four Gospels and their authors and inferred that they held a high place in the church at his time and before. He writes, quote, Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect. While Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. Luke, also the companion of Paul, recorded in the book the gospel preached by him. Afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who also had leaned upon his breast, did himself publish a gospel during his residence at Ephesus in Asia. End of quote. A little later, he wrote, Irenaeus wrote, it is not possible that the gospels can be either more or fewer in number than they are. And in fact, this was quoted on the program I watched the other night. An interesting thing about reading the early church fathers, such as St. Justin Martyr and Irenaeus and the others, is that they describe the beliefs and the practices of the Catholic Church that we know today. And any informed Catholic would feel quite at home when they read these. In other words, in the church that Irenaeus is describing and Polycarp is describing, we'd feel very much at home today if we could go back and attend those churches and experience those liturgies that they describe and the sacraments that they describe.
So we're coming to the close of our time once again. Ron, thank you for preparing some wonderful material here for us. And we say to all our listeners, may God bless you always and in all ways. Amen.